And we will move on to the third case of this morning, Martinez against the City of Chicago.
May it please the court. My name is Nicholas Lopanti. I'm the attorney for the appellant Rocio Martinez. This is the first opportunity that I've had to argue matter before this distinguished panel. The issue in this case is whether the February 9, 2006 order that dismissed plaintiff's claim for want of prosecution violated plaintiff's right to due process. The appellant is asking the court to review the facts and law under de novo review under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 60B4, not Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 60B1, as a void judgment. The facts actually stem from 1506, January 5 of 06 to 29 of 06, are the times to be considered. On January 5th of 06, I was not able to appear in court due to a medical emergency with my elderly father.
But let me just kind of cut to the chase here, Mr. Lopanti, because we have two rulings from the district court, each of which could be construed as a final judgment. We've got the dismissal on February 9, 2006, and then some motions after that, and then we can fast forward up to the summer of 2006, July 7, where he actually enters a Rule 58 final judgment. And in each instance, there are some motions filed. And giving you the absolute greatest benefit of the doubt that I can from a procedural point of view, it seems to me we could look at the July 7 Rule 58 final judgment as the once and for all final word on dismissal for want of prosecution, and a motion to reconsider brought within 10 business days, which is ultimately denied, and a notice of appeal, and there we would have the merits of everything before us. I know the city hasn't made that argument, but the truth is, once you get to the merits, what I see in this case is a lengthy course of conduct that leads the district judge, after warning, you certainly could view the February 9 order as a minimum, as a pretty strong warning. Warnings and warnings that this case is courting this kind of dismissal, and I don't see how we could find that the judge acted beyond his authority to do it, even if I give you all of those procedural benefits of the doubt. So I guess I need to know what you think excuses this pattern of failing to comply with the court's orders, failing to keep up with what the court's doing?
Judge, quite frankly, there was no real pattern. What had occurred, Judge, on January 5th, on the court date of the first problem that occurred, Judge, is that we never received notice of that particular order with regard to the filing of supplemental disclosures. And, Judge, we really look at the record, there hasn't been that much of a problem which existed from the time that I entered a case with another corporation counsel, with all due respect.
But there were lots of other status. You missed a status hearing on May 18th, 2005. You missed another hearing in October. You missed another hearing in November. I'm not saying there weren't, you know, reasons here and there, but if you can't attend to a case, the court sooner or later would be within its discretion to say you've got to do something different.
Judge, on one matter with regard to not attending, I would have an agreement with counsel, and that would be David Shedd on many occasions. I had three motions for extension of time also, which the record shows. And even on the one date when I could not appear, it was a motion to vacate a DWP that was granted on the next time around, and I was in fact in court on that time, Judge. And if we look at, we come back to the January 5th date, Judge. On that particular day, counsel knew and the court knew that I couldn't be there because of a medical emergency for my father with viral pneumonia. With that in mind, Judge, we checked the computer time and time again with regard to that order or that warning that said if you don't get supplemental disclosures in, which are very simple, Your Honor, and certainly wouldn't have stood in my hands with regard to a simple thing like this with a warning, which actually is a constitutional argument on our part saying that I'm going to allow a dismissal with prejudice to occur just because of supplemental disclosures. And that particular order, Judge, was not postmarked until January 34th. The date to comply with January 20th with the supplemental disclosures. The disclosures had been provided before. Also, a number of discovery matters had been propounded to the defendants. Now, we checked the computer time and time again, called the clerk's office. I also, maybe I shouldn't have done that, I relied on opposing counsel, new opposing counsel from the city. I received a voicemail weeks after I had called. And in essence, and maybe I shouldn't have relied on it, Your Honor, it stated that there's just be another discovery status on February 9th. What happens on February 9th? It's not a discovery status. It's dismissed with prejudice, Your Honor. So that's why I say the proper view for the court to look at is under 60B4. I know the court is concentrating on things that were...
I can't imagine how this can be a 60B4 case. There's nothing void about what the judge did. Maybe the judge shouldn't have dismissed as quickly. Maybe there were problems with getting orders, but there's nothing void about this judgment. There's subject matter jurisdiction. There was personal jurisdiction. You were counsel of record.
Judge, you're arguing lack of notice. And at that point in time, there was no notice whatsoever.
You had
no
notice on February 1st.
I'm sorry?
You got the notice on February 1st.
February 2nd.
February 2nd.
It was postmarked.
And you waited a week to get the disclosures in. The hearing was on February 9th. I mean, you did have notice. It was late, but you had it.
Your Honor, but it was
so this
passed.
Is not a lack of notice case.
Well, notice to the fact of the warning, Your Honor. The warning is if it wasn't in by the 20th, that there would be a dismissal with prejudice. So it was way beyond that, from the 20th to February 2nd when we received it. So at that point in time, there was nothing for us to do but on the February 9th to appear, and we had faxed the disclosure that morning to the Corporation Counsel.
Why did it take a week to do that?
Judge, we just waited for the status because we felt there was no reason.
Why didn't you do it immediately once you got the notice?
Reason
on February
being, Judge,
1st or 2nd, whichever date it was.
Judge, it's the same thing that I did when I got the notice on the first motion for DWP when I had injured my leg. I filed a motion to vacate and was set for a certain day. Due to the fact it was February 9th, we set it for that day, Your Honor. That's the only reason. It was 7 days later because we were already at that point from the 20th of January to 2nd.
I'm not tracking with your answer. Why didn't you file the disclosures on the same day you received the notice, recognizing that you were about to be dismissed because the warning was in that notice?
Judge, I believe that the notice that was provided or the minute order that we received on February 2nd, the case was already dismissed. So I didn't believe it was an urgency at that point in time, but to then bring that before the court on February 9th just to explain it at that time, Your Honor. That's the only reason.
You thought it was already dismissed?
Yes, Judge, because the order indicated if we did not file supplemental disclosures by January 20th, the case would be dismissed with prejudice.
Right.
And we did not receive that. It was postmarked the envelope for the minute order January 31st,
I know,
Your Honor.
It was, and so does Judge Sykes. And the thing that's baffling, I think, to me as well, especially if you thought it was dismissed when you got it on February 1st or 2nd, why you didn't quickly move in with a motion to reinstate it as you had done before. I mean, the decision to just sit around and wait for a week is an odd one.
Well, I don't know if you could term it odd, Judge. It was just a timing factor, basically, with regard to an attorney's cases in his own portfolio, if you will, and a date for February 9th, because in my mind, I thought that, well, since we hadn't gotten notice, it's postmarked January 31st, we made calls to the clerk, I got nothing back. We were assured from Corporation Counsel, in fact, that this is just going to be a discovery status. I saw no reason, and I thought, quite frankly, that there would be no problem on February 9th by presenting this argument, Your Honor. That's the only reason. I mean, I'm not saying I should have acted the next day, February 3rd, which I don't know on February 3rd what day that was, but I felt that there was no reason to do it at that point in time because I thought that on February 9th it would be no problem from the court.
All right. If you want to save a minute for rebuttal,
right, Your Honor.
Now would be the time. Mr. Schultz?
May it please the court. The district court determined that there was a clear pattern of delay on Martinez's part, both before and after her case was dismissed in February 2006. And that's why the court refused to vacate that dismissal. The district court explained that even assuming that Martinez learned of some deadlines late, she did not adequately seek extensions or justify her overall pattern with any excuse. She still has not come to grips with that record, so her arguments on appeal missed the mark.
Now, Mr. Schultz, I have to say, In the circumstances of this case, the fact that there is something entered on February the 9th that says case dismissed for want of prosecution, civil case terminated, and then another thing entered on July 7th that also, this one's the Rule 58 order, says it's terminated, is confusing at best, right? And I know in your brief you try to work through a number of different things this might be, but district judges can't just keep entering final judgments, and yet when the Rule 58 final judgment is the one that's the last in time, the cases from this court indicate that a party is, in fact, entitled to rely on that as the really, really final judgment, no matter what language may have been used in earlier orders. So if that's the case, then why isn't this appeal at least properly before us? I'm not sure how much good that will do Mr. Lapante or Ms. Martinez, but why isn't the real final judgment the July 7 judgment?
Well, actually, we think it is, Your Honor.
Appeal. Then reach back and say this other motion to reconsider somehow means there can't be a motion to reconsider. But if there hadn't been a final judgment, I've seen lots of people in the middle of cases file motions that are erroneously labeled Rule 60 motions or that are erroneously labeled Rule 59 motions. But then when there's finally a Rule 58 final judgment and then they come in on the 20th of July with a motion to reconsider, it seems to me, at least in the interest of orderly procedure, we should just disregard all those other things that don't relate to the real final judgment anyway.
Well, first of all, Barrero speaks directly to this issue, and the judgment depends how you mean judgment. Under Rule 54, judgment is any order from which appeal lies. And the February 9th dismissal was a final judgment from which appeal could have been taken as soon as it was entered on the docket on February 20th.
Right, but we've had cases where people have had this kind of confusing situation, which I wish didn't arise. You know, if there were a little bit more crossing of the T's and dotting of the I's, you wouldn't be in this position, nor would we. But when multiple potential opportunities to appeal exist, we've said you can wait until the Rule 58 judgment.
Absolutely. In Barrero, there the litigant, after the judge pronounced the final judgment, but before the Rule 58 separate document was entered, the litigant filed a Rule 59E. The court explained that the 59E could be filed before the 58 document was entered on the docket, and the effect of that Rule 59E was really the same as if it had been filed after the 58.
Right.
The deadline under both Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4 and Civil Procedure 59 is no later than 10 days after entry of judgment.
It doesn't have to be.
The 58 judgment or separate document could, of course, be waived. It's not a jurisdictional requirement.
Or the other thing is that thing that they labeled a 59E. I mean, in Barrero, it was one sort of thing, but Judge Zagel's doing different things. He's imposing sanctions. He doesn't seem to think the case is over with before him during that period of time.
Conditions on reconsideration. So the judgment was never modified in any way at all from the dismissal on February 9th when it was first pronounced and entered on the docket on February 20th. The notice of appeal could have immediately been filed and an appeal would have been mature. And furthermore, that judgment made under Rule 51B would be with prejudice. So there's no modification of the judgment at any point. The conditions are on the motion to reinstate. And the motion to reinstate, as Barrero explains, even if the motion to the motion to reconsider under 59 is filed before the entry of the separate document under Rule 58, only the first judgment or the first motion to reconsider tolls the time to appeal. So under Barrero, the same day district court docketed the denial of Rule 59 relief and the Rule 58 judgment. After that, there were more 59 judgments, Rule 59 motions, which were in fact timely because they were within 10 business days, but they did not toll the time to appeal. Same thing happens here. And the motion to reconsider, that was the basis for the conditions on reinstatement. And it had nothing to do with the underlying judgment, with which the district court explained on July 6th he stood by and was not vacating that judgment.
Right. Yeah, no, he certainly...
So that judgment was final and unmodified.
It underscores that unless he didn't mean to do something before, but you can't have, as you were just, I think, implying, a second Rule 59e motion after your first Rule 59e motion has been denied.
But you can't have a 59 from the 60b, which is what we think happened here. And the purpose for that rule, as Barrero explains, is that to have multiple Rule 59 motions would have the effect of doing an end run around the limits on the time to appeal, because the 59 motion is directed at a mistake in the underlying judgment. So when that's not modified, the longstanding rule of the circuit articulated by Charles V. Daly is that you can't have another 59, you can't toll the time to appeal. But as you say, when you asked the question, you made the point, or I should say, you suggested that it wouldn't make any difference in this case anyway, which is, in fact, our point. No matter what orders are before this court or the precise scope of review, Martinez has not shown that the court abused its discretion. We simply don't see that this is a void judgment. The circumstances made perfectly plain that dismissal was likely to come, so there was even no lack of warning under Ball and the other cases. And furthermore, the argument that the judgment is void really conflates the requirement of a warning under Ball in this court's other cases that does not come from due process in the first place. So the only argument, as far as the city can determine, that's properly before this court is the Rule 60B argument about voidness, and it's simply misses the mark. So unless there are any questions, we ask this court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you. Mr. LaPonta, you have a minute.
Your Honor, quite simply, the second order of 7606 altered the first order dismissing for want of prosecution, because the second order granted our motion reconsideration and dismissed it with prejudice. And once again, that second order altered the first order again, which Charles V. Daly supports our case, and Barrero is distinguished, because the court talked about costs and fees that were not paid in time. But these costs and fees were paid in time. There was no order for the costs and fees to be paid at a certain time. In fact, the court stated, if you feel they're unreasonable, you could come back and let us know.
Well, it was in the docketed version of the order. It wasn't in the court's oral statement. He said March 14th.
Judge, there was no order to pay by a certain day, only to discuss with counsel, and we could come back and speak to the judge. In fact, the judge said also in the order that I can live with that, the money issue, what about the second one? Which means another attorney filing an appearance by 4-1306. That attorney filed his appearance in 4-1306. So two of the conditions were met, Your Honor. With regard to the Barrero case, in Barrero...
If you just wrap up, that would be fine.
Yeah. The Barrero case, Judge, that case stands for a case that was not altered at all. It was successive motions. We had it right in this case because Charles V. Daly indicates that if, in fact, there is an alteration of a prior judgment, that would be allowed to file a successive petition under 59E, which would then start the tolling for the time of the appeal, which is filed on 10-11-06.
Okay. Thank you very much. We will take the case under advisement.